have online? Heidi? Okay. Hi, Heidi. Heidi Pond is our computer. And Rick, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay. Okay. Rick Dubb is our past president. I'm Ann Hodges. I'm the secretary of the Enchantment Center, past president. Welcome to our second annual Systems Engineering Challenge. Rick Dubb, last year I said, well, I'm going to advertise, you know, the event as our first annual. But we don't know if it's going to be a hit or not. Well, you're here today, so I think it was reasonably, you know, I enjoyed it. Let's see. Heidi, did you want to give any opening remarks?
You know, I think I'm kind of alone for the ride since I'm remote and obviously uninformed about what's going on.
All right. So with that, I think I'll go ahead and just have everybody go around the table, introduce themselves briefly, their name, you know, their position, and where they're from. Okay? Ann Hodges, Sandia National Laboratories, systems engineer and deputy program manager for a complex R&D program at Sandia, as well as the lead SC for a mission assurance framework that's at the laboratory level. Okay. All right. So, one little trick about tonight is that because we have remote participants, we're going to be passing the phone around. There's no speakerphone. So, okay. So, Scott.
All right. I'm Scott Smith. I work for FSC, and I'm the chief engineer for the EGIS program in the Air Force.
Jim Larkin. WI Technologies here in town, based in Houston. I also work on the EDIS program at the SFC at Kirtland, and I'm a mission engagement lead and senior systems engineer.
Paul McGoey, retired Boeing and Lockmart, and basically currently working as factotum and general support for NextGenis energy systems, and background is classic systems engineering, system optimization, configuration for both subsonic and supersonic.
Toby Krako, I'm a production engineer at Valero Technologies, across the street from this group. Background is materials engineering, and mostly just here to learn about.
Mary Compton, I'm the chapter treasurer, and I work at Sandia National Lab. I do modeling systems engineering for a couple of different weapons systems and assembly now.
I'm Phil Bannon. I'm at Sandia Lab. I manage a new group called System Engineering Foundation.
I'm Cheryl Bolstad. I'm also on the board of directors for the local Wincozy chapter. I too am at Sandia National Lab, but I am in the human factors department.
Need more human factors.
Kyle Spizak. I'm new to Sandia, kind of, and I'm in mission assurance.
Robert Hill, I'm from San Diego National Laboratories. I work in the Power Sources Group. And I'm an amateur at systems engineering, I guess. I have some experience in the Air Force, but I was doing a system engineering program. Picked up a lot of training, but I don't have any like formal education.
Okay, thank you. We have one more person that just joined us, but he is getting his food and drink, so I'll have him introduce himself in a minute or two. So, Heidi and Rick, did you want to introduce yourself, please?
Okay. I am Heidi
Cohen
at the Amphibious Radio Space Lab. I work with
the current. I can barely hear you, Heidi. This is it.
So I'm Peggy Hunt. I am the current president of the chapter. I'm recently retired from Ottawa National Laboratory. Of course, autonomy is a term of art since we were working as the adjunct faculty and in project management,
Thank you, Heidi. Rick? Well, I'm Rick Dove. I'm past president of this chapter. I moved down of state at the beginning of the year. I now live in Anthem, Arizona. You can't resign as past president, it turns out. So I am I am what I am. I teach at Stevens Institute of Technology and also at Caltech now. Agile hardware development. Agile hardware development.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Rick is one of the original movers and shapers of the agile concept in systems engineering. Okay, and we have one more person that needs to introduce himself.
Gary Frederick, Sandy Lab, this is Mike Mecca, write our signatures, et cetera, et cetera. I've been here 39 years, and I'm a third.
Lucky man. Okay. So we are ready to move on to our challenges. What I would like you to do is take a hard copy and pass it on. And because Mary and I did not want to wrestle with getting a projector going with a laptop that has never been connected up before, and being good systems engineers and wanting to do integration testing prior to going live, we decided to go with the backup version of low-tech solution. Okay. All right. So does everybody have a copy? Okay. So I'll introduce this event by saying that the notion is networking and exploring the challenges that have been submitted by a couple of us, chapter members, and we want to collaboratively discuss the nature of the challenge and just kind of explore some suggestions, you know, how do we overcome the issues, what are the issues, and amplify the positive aspects. So, without further ado, let's move on to slide 2. Okay. Our first challenge, actually there were 3 altogether. Rick submitted two challenges, and I submitted the second that actually my co-collaborator with this collaborator is Heidi Kahn, and she and I are working on standing up a working group, an ENCOSI working group, on what systems engineering practices should be in play for early stage R&D. So, wanting to get more information about that, put you guys to work, I submitted that. So, Rick, do you want to go ahead and start off with challenge topic 1? Introduce that to everybody.
Sure.
We're on slide 3.
Okay, so maybe some of you have, and maybe some of you haven't, heard of the FUSE project, F-U-S-E, which is the Future of Systems Engineering. This is a multi-organization collaboration. It's rather large. It's got I'm not going to do justice to all the members, but NDIA is one of the collaborators. IEEE is a collaborator. The System Engineering Research Center is a collaborator. And there's a bunch of others that I can't remember. The project has been going on for a couple years, trying to reach a consensus amongst all those groups as to what the future of system engineering is going to look like. which I haven't seen much in the way of a profile of what it's going to look like. So I'm going to show you one. But in any event, it has now gotten to the point where instead of sitting around and talking amongst themselves, they have opened up a number of projects on specific topic areas. One of those topic areas is on agility, and I am not leading that project, but I am collaborating with the leader of the project, who's in fact a member of the Agile Systems Engineering Working Group. I am leading the project on system security. And what we're talking about, of course, is system security in the future of systems engineering. The statement that is on this particular slide 3 alludes to the fact that we've got to understand the environment that will shape the future of system engineering, as opposed to just making something up that we would like to see happen and may not. So what we've got to do is basically try to figure out what is the environment going to look like in that future that will shape successful systems engineering. And the way I tell that story is it's all done by natural selection. If you try to do something in system engineering that's out of whack with what the environment requires, it won't work. And so it's natural selection that's actually happening. All the time, all around us, in the kinds of things that work and the kinds of things that don't. And as I have said, I think somewhere here or maybe in a prior slide, the environment owns what goes on. And it will look favorably upon those processes and those systems that are in fact compatible with it. And compatibility in this sense doesn't mean everybody's happy with everybody. What it means is homeostasis is achieved, which is another way of saying there's a tendency toward equilibrium. You put something new into an environment, everything has to adjust in order to make room for this something new that just got put into the environment. Well, in trying to figure out what the future environment is going to look like, that is in fact going to shape what will be successful as systems engineering, we don't have to guess at it. William Gibson has very famously said and often been quoted for saying the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet, I say. This is true. I mean, things don't just appear all of a sudden out of nowhere that never were before of any usefulness. They creep into existence. Something that actually works gets accepted and amplified and leveraged, and more of it starts happening like that. And so from my point of view, I can say we don't have to dream up wild things. If you can't actually point to some examples of something that's going on in such a way that it looks like it's an early stage trend, then what you're thinking about probably isn't going to happen. I mean, there's another way of looking at things too. I mean, in terms of new companies that are trying to bring new products to market, most of which fail, both the companies and the products, do so because of timing. They try to come out with something that really sounds wonderful. Everybody likes how it sounds, but there's no infrastructure. There's no ecosystem that will support its successfulness. And so what I'm really getting at here is trying to build a profile of what I'll refer to as the problem space. If the solution is going to be system engineering in the future, what does the problem space in the future look like that system engineering has to be compatible with if it's going to succeed? So anyway, I'm in the course of of writing a paper with some collaborators on the basics of what that future looks like, along with some suggested strategies that would be necessary in order to deal with such a future. And this first topic here, and we can move on to slide four. This first topic here is basically trying to build a profile, a short list profile of general concepts that I would like to think are comprehensive, which is to say, you can think of lots more things, but I'm hoping that whatever you think of, for the most part, would fall under one of these categories that we have here, because we are looking for a short list that gives us some ability to start understanding what's the nature of that future look like. Now, on the left-hand side, I have offered what I believe to be what I call the curve of in the future for system engineering, and on the right-hand side, the curve for system security. And CURVE is an acronym that comes from the five categories you see there: caprice, uncertainty, risk, variation, evolution, which has been a tool that's been in use now for, I think, 5 or 6 years, and been very successful in characterizing problem spaces. And so I thought it would be an appropriate profiling tool for characterizing mainly what I'm interested in is on the right, what the future of system security has to look like in order to fit with the environment that will exist. On the left-hand side, where I have general SE curve elements, on the right-hand side, I have general system security characteristics. There is very purposely pretty much a one-to-one correspondence between what you see on the left as a system engineering statement and what you see on the right in the way it might instantiate as a system security characterization. Some of the work on the other project I'm participating in, which is trying to define basically the agile space in the future, is led by Keith Ouellette. The interesting thing is Keith Ouellette is a very active security guy, but he's not leading this security project. I'm the most active agile guy, but I'm not leading the agile project. And there's a little bit of malice aforethought there, so that those of us who think we are on the leading edge don't necessarily try to walk away with the whole topic. Okay, so both sides of this profile here are up for grabs. And when I say up for grabs, what I'm trying to do is have a discussion with those of you who want to participate in this discussion on what some of these things mean, and in the end, whether or not you think there's something that's glaring in its non-presence here that needs to be thought of as well. Now, in the paper that Keith Ouellette is lead author on, he's done an interesting job that includes, amongst other things, what you see here at the very top on the left-hand side, survivability, which he refers to as the current order. And the current order is what I refer to as the environment, the operational environment that things have to operate in. And he and I both recognize that current order compatibility is a reasonable phrase to use here, because the environment establishes the current order of who lives and dies, or what lives and dies in that environment. If we look down at the next one in the uncertainty area, he's also described, he's basically saying that the key thing about system engineering, especially in the adaptable space, is systems have to be survivable, they have to have relevance, and they have to be viable. And that's pretty much the three things that he claims dictate the goal of systems. And so I've, of course, included these here because caprice is another way of saying unpredictability. But you couldn't have an acronym that had two U's to start with. So we chose the word caprice, which means the same thing. Okay, so from an unpredictable point of view, survivability is unpredictable. Something that come out of nowhere and swat you down. Does somebody want to say something?
Cheryl was giving you a hard time.
Oh.
Attempting.
Okay.
I had a general question. This is Ann.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the left side elements and the right side elements aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. Like, for example, let's look at variation. The operational environments and social compatibility would also be relevant for the system security side, the right side. Can you speak to the criteria for putting elements on one side or the other?
Well, the elements on the left side are not meant to deal with specific considerations that have to be thought about for security. They're instead meant to be specific considerations you have to think about when you think about system engineering in general. The right-hand side is a subset of system engineering. It's the security part of system engineering. Each one of those bullets in the paper will have many items listed underneath it that will expand upon what that bullet means. In the variation area, on the left side where we see social compatibility, you know, I glossed over this concept of social here. I think I said something on slide 2 where, you know, people have been talking about cyber systems for a long time. Now they're talking about cyber physical systems, and I'm suggesting we need to talk about cyber physical social systems because the systems we're dealing with and having to deal with even more not only have social components to them, that social part is going to be more and more important. From a security point of view, well, I mean, you might think that the social part of interest to systems has to do with the human beings, and I'm going to say that's not what I mean. What I really mean is relationships amongst participants, and those participants may be human beings. They may also be components. And that's especially important when we look in the security space where we're coming to understand that a component in a large system or a system within a system of systems has to have effective social relationships with the other components or the other systems if it's actually going to survive. It needs a community. So when I'm looking on the left side as social compatibility as a variation, what I'm really referring to there is there is a variation in how socially compatible a system is in its environment, as well as its components are within the system, whether they're people or things. On the right-hand side, when I'm trying to understand what might be the key social aspect of interest there, is I'm talking about priority conflicts where we've got some elements in a system, some of whom are human, some of whom are components, and they're relying on social relationships in a community and collaborative environment in order to be aware of threats that are pending, be aware of what others are doing about them. But if all of a sudden I'm a component, let's say, and I'm under attack, and I'm hoping I can get some help from some other elements in the system, but they've got problems of their own. And so there's a conflict of priorities about how effective our relationship is going to be at that moment, right?
Okay, well, it seems to me like, you know, I saw some people that had their brows furrowed a little bit. I'm going to poke on Cheryl. Okay, so let's maybe dwell a little bit on the variation aspect here for the operating environment, social compatibility versus social priority conflict. What are your thoughts? And I'm going to hand the phone over to Cheryl.
I think you should tell him what I saw first. Well, I guess... Rick, my one question to you is, obviously, as you know, I'm fairly new to systems engineering. Is it common to use these type of interrelational or psychological principles to describe engineering components? Because I find that odd. When I think things social, I tend to think of people, not people and machines, or machines and machines, using them to refer machines or component to component, as opposed to component to system.
Yeah.
So, is that common?
No, I don't want to claim it's common. But what I want to suggest is try and hear how I'm using the word social. I'm using it not in the sense that we are all typically using it every day about relationships between people. I'm using it about relationships between anything and anything that have a collaborative nature to them, that have a conversational nature to them, that have a give and take, a helpful nature to that relationship. And, you know, from a people point of view in the security environment, very much what we're looking at is, I'll pick on government agencies who don't want to share anything with anybody else, even in the other government agencies, about what they understand about security threats and security responses. I don't want to say that so absolutely. It's gotten better than it was a number of years ago, but it's still very secretive. Everybody's protecting their information instead of collaborating. The future of system engineering is going to require collaboration to be successful, and that's also true very much in security. It's a complex world. It's changing very rapidly. Nobody, in an isolated sense, is going to be able to deal with the issues by themselves. Now, from a component point of view, we have almost one-to-one same type of relationship activities. For instance, let's say you've got a swarm of drones that are going out on a mission to find a cave, go into the cave, explore the cave, and shoot the bad guys. On the way to that, they all have an understanding of what their mission and flight plan is, but they will be unsuccessful in the long run if they don't do peer-peer behavior monitoring, which is to say, if one of them gets hacked or just simply gets sick, the mission gets some jeopardy put onto it. And so the issue there is one of peer components monitoring the behavior of other components to make sure everything looks healthy. We see this already in ad hoc networks, where there are nodes out there that are basically that basically can't trust absolutely all the other nodes. And a common set of techniques for dealing with situations like that is nodes start comparing notes with each other about what they think about other specific nodes. One node may say, you know, I'm getting communication from this other node that's looking a little different than it usually is. What do you think? And votes get taken. This is a common practice in ad hoc networks. And so we're seeing this concept of collaboration between components as something that in the environments we're starting to work in becomes more and more necessary. Did that help?
It does. So what I'm thinking is when you're talking about the nodes having to work together closely, reach compatibility means that if one of these nodes goes awry, I'm more susceptible to having the whole network go awry.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what you're referring to.
Absolutely. But peer behavior, karma, breach, criticality, those are presumably two separate elements, right, that are worth individual discussion under the operational environment situation. I mean, a breach happens, a breach happens. How critical is it in this specific instance? Maybe in another environment it's extremely critical, but over here it's not so critical. So you would respond differently. The operational environment, the variation is also the behavior amongst your peers, whether you're a component or a person.
No, I guess. Okay. That makes sense. I'm sorry. Okay.
So the criticality of a breach.
Yeah, let me ask.
Depend upon.
Let me ask a question. Who's keeping... Who's keeping time on how long?
This is Anne.
Yeah.
I grabbed the phone, Cheryl. But I'll give it back, I promise.
No.
I promise, Cheryl.
I'm asking who's keeping time on how long we can be on one topic.
We have another 5 minutes, I think.
Okay.
If we want to kind of split between the three topics, although I think tonight we may only get to two. lot of energy here. Okay, so criticality of a breach may be dependent upon the perspective of a component. You know, its notion of what mission it's, and I'm thinking system of systems.
Yeah.
There was a local perspective, but who's the kind of the gatekeeper of the global perspective of breach and criticality? Who judges that?
Well, that's another social aspect of behavior monitoring, and some of the principles that we're looking at basically says a component has to be self-protective, right? It can't believe that it can just deal with its deliverable functionality and ignore security because someone else is taking care of it. It can't do that and survive. That came out very close, very poignantly at Stuxnet. They all thought they were within a sterile environment. So a given type of, security systems learn in one way or another how to detect certain types of threats that have been seen before. And so here you are, a system or a component within a system or a system within a system. It doesn't really matter at what level that is. And something that has happened before is happening now, and you are aware of that. You may be a component or you may be the security specialist that's watching what's going on. And the issue in all cases is to assess how critical this particular breach in this environment at this point in time is, because you're going to have to devote resources to dealing with it. And yes, it may be a security breach, but it may be of no consequence or of insufficient consequence to shut everything down, for instance, or to take certain extreme actions.
Yeah, this is assessment, but isn't your more criticality, it's not the known attack methods, it's the unknown attack. It's determining the criticality of a breach versus knowing, hey, you know, this is a denial of service type of attack or something like that. I mean, am I missing the point?
Yeah, you're missing the point. I didn't mean to have the focus go on to what's known versus unknown. The issue is one of evaluating what is the criticality at this moment with this thing that's happening. And that will be different in different places. Even though it's the same kind of breach, the criticality will be different in different places and at different times.
On the attack vendor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, also, it may be, another way to look at this, it may be normally considered a very highly critical breach, but there are five other breaches going on at the same time that are much higher, and you can't deal with them all. At least not all at the same time, perhaps, right? So it's
a consequence of the impact evaluation.
Yeah, I mean, this is attempting to describe the general environment of that a security system will operate in. So that subsequently you can say, okay, after maybe a page worth of explanation of the kinds of things that breach criticality mean, then you have to develop a general strategy, or at least I have to develop a general strategy as opposed to specific tactics, a general strategy that says, okay, if I'm in an environment where breach criticality varies, or I should say, if I'm trying to think about security where breach criticality varies in different contexts, what kind of a strategic considerations do I have to give in order to deal with that environmental fact? And that would be a topic two element, or we're saying, what's a general strategy consideration, not a tactic, not an objective, just a recognition that we have to have a strategy that deals with this breach criticality issue.
Well, Rick,
yeah.
Unfortunately, we're kind of running out of time. Is there one last pruning question or comment before we move on to the next topic?
What I was really hoping was
what were you, Rich?
I was hoping for the impossible, that we would be able to have a good discussion on all these points, but that can't happen in 20 minutes.
Oh, I know. Rich, okay. As head of the Professional Development Committee, I plead with you to please give a chapter talk on fascinating. And Cheryl said she'd love to know the definitions of all of these aspects in your profile.
Well, I'll probably have a draft paper that deals with that, ready for. I'll have a paper for IS-20.
Oh, excellent. Okay, but I hope you will consider giving a talk on this, and we'd be delighted to maybe be the dry run for IS-20.
Okay.
How about that?
Sure, I mean, sure.
Jim has a comment.
No, in COSI webinars, there are three.
You're delivering coming up?
Yes, I'm giving a seminar next week. I think it's on the 18th, I think. Yeah. It's an
encoding. And what's the topic?
The topic is on continuous integration platforms.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually two topics that will be covered, but the abstract doesn't say that. It just says it's going to be on continuous integration platforms. It's also going to be on stakeholder engagement. These are two of the eight key findings we currently recognize, because more are coming, for the ASE-LCM project that's almost completed.
Okay, well, one of the things that I admire about Rick is that he thinks deeply and broadly about a number of different fascinating topics. And so, Rick, I'm going to tune into that webinar, and thank you for reminding me, Jim.
Yeah, you will.
Okay. All right, well, Rick, thank you very much for submitting topic number one. Let's move on to topic number two. I'm going to get a fresh sheet for the flip chart here. And title it topic two. Okay. So I extracted some slides from a panel discussion that Heidi Hahn and I participated in at the ENCOSI International Symposium in July. And the topic is systems engineering and early stage R&D projects.
Just
an
introduction. Mm-hmm. My role was introduced as the summit actually in Sapporo. That was one of the
most important topics. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so we're on slide number five. Moving on to the next slide. Unfortunately, the formatting when I copied it in didn't have the slide number on it. Is there a slide six? Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. So these are just some of the thoughts that I provided for the panel discussion. And this is just kind of the stage, the environment here. So what are the challenges in applying systems engineering to early stage R&D? Well, what I found is that SE practices are unfamiliar to researchers, and you need to reframe those topics. One of my favorite examples is configuration management. So I would tell some of the scientists and other engineers that I work with on my program, okay, well, how are we going to do configuration management? They'd look at me like I lost confidence, right? But if I would say, well, how are you going to, preserve your experimental plan so that it's available to the team? And then what about where are you going to capture your results? And they go, oh, yeah, oh, okay. So reframing is important. The next thing is determining what are the work-side practices that support future maturation and scalability. What is the right level of rigor for early stage R&D? And we want to not squash, but nurture creativity and exploration while preserving research quality and defensible research. I think Sandia certainly is beyond the point in time where we say, and Gary can back me up on this, who heard this, well, I hire smart people, you just got to trust me. Yeah, right. So, and SEs are typically more familiar with hiring. Okay, moving on to slide seven. When should systems engineering be applied to early stage R&D? And what are the triggers that could identify when SE should be applied? Well, in my opinion, as early as possible, right? And it should be done for all projects. And it's India in the mission assurance framework that I'm one of the co-authors of, primary authors. Regardless of whether you're doing, research or you're doing a pathfinder, there are some core mission assurance requirements that you need to meet. Okay, moving on to slide eight. Is there a compelling value proposition for selling the idea
of SE to early stage R&D projects? Well, you know, I'm all about the Goldilocks principle. What is just right? Okay, right size rigor. And when I say rigor, I mean timing, scope, and amount. Timing, how early, how often, scope, the breadth and depth of the kinds of activities that you're doing, and the formality. You know, who signs off on it, who has access to the artifacts, and what is the form of the artifacts itself? Is it, you know, just like a one sheet, you know, approach, or is it a tome, a plan, right? And we want to develop a pull versus a push. And the people that are closest to it, what are their ideas for practices that preserve their quality? And again, reframing is important. And I found that in coaching the system investigator and the technical team lead in the practices, I don't necessarily tell them you're doing systems engineering, but I'll say, well, how do you know what it is you're supposed to do? That, you know, what is the right, what are you delivering? Oh, yeah, okay, so those are the requirements, right? Okay. And then templates and examples. We don't want these folks to start with a blank sheet of paper. Slide 9. So, okay, I talked about the mission assurance framework, right? So, in answering the SE concepts, which are the ones that have the biggest bang for the buck in the project, really? What are the practices when applied early? Support future growth. If there is a desire to productionize the R&D's focus area. And what you see there is a list of what we require all projects to do. And for those of us at Sandia, I'll put it in terms of this is Division 5000, this is the National Security Program, and a couple of ground system, flight system centers in Division 6000. Okay? So, are these the right set of requirements? I don't know. I think so. So, I want to open it up to you guys. And Heidi, do you have anything else you want to add to this? Because you're a co-conspirator here.
Overhead stuff. And so one of the comments that we got, and violently disagrees with him, is to not use the word rigor. It implies this process-bound thing that doesn't really do anything. So that was one interesting thing. But also, you know, that we need a way to overcome that whole reaction to systems engineering in general, not only in application to early stage R&D projects. Like Rick, we are planning to write a paper, and I will be taking the lead on that since I'm the only retired person out of the four of us. The band lead.
Okay, thank you, Heidi. All right, so what do you guys think? Yeah.
It's from this Hero Summit. I registered for this and spoke to it in the Sapporo Summit because at that time I was just wrapping up a 2-year study in early stage R&D and the application of directed energy. And the challenges that I found were multi-dimensional, if you will. I agree with, I think all of these, I think some of these might be nested within others. For instance, change control and requirements management, project charter, and those three are all extremely closely linked. The challenges that I saw were, enforcement, basically the discipline, rather, that's applied to each of these. Because, and what I saw was, getting back to Rick's thing on the social thing, but more the interpersonal social, because you have your IPT lead, typically academic professional type people, right? And so you've got a personality type, that generally describes that profession, right? And then you have government people and the different hierarchy within government. You have military, at least in our case, I don't know, India probably has too, right? And then contractors. So between those three different types of levels, and add that, like you say, to the whole aspect of where did the discipline come in? And I think, in terms of the government participation, you have the government lead versus the government rank file, and so that's kind of a subset of those. And what I found was, as a systems engineer in the R&D, early stage R&D, trying to manage that, and for instance, with the change control process, there was no enforcement mechanism at all for change control. And when a person with influence would say something that was contrary to what the charter called for, or, you're halfway through this, a year into the study, and then, oh, we want to change gears and do this. And, or you have your IPT lead that says, well, I'm not going to do it this way. I'm going to do it this way. Without getting into, specifics that I can't really get into those specifics, but the idea is, okay, we approached it with a problem statement and, a path to coming up with where to invest. The future investment in directed energy. And then it's like the grapevine is in which that Jenny dangerously, in the prison there, he says, first guy says, yeah, your brother's been arrested. They're gonna put him in prison. And it goes all the way around the chain. And, the guy says, yeah, the dog barked into the lumber yard. Oh, God, my brother's going to prison. It's like, that's not what I said. Yeah, but I know this grapevine.
The informal network.
Yeah, and so this, all this kind of impacts the outcome, and it really that I can say is that, you know, into the process, I was in a newbie, you know, in the process, and you know, people are saying, well, we need to show the effect, you know, that this X, Y, Z solution is effective. And I said, no, our job is to show the bounds of applicability of these solutions. So that way the people that are in charge can make a determination on how to invest this stuff. And so that, you know, even that, something as simple as that is, you know, can color this.
Jim, is it possible that you could share that study?
No, I
can't. Oh. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I'm very sorry. Okay.
Okay,
very good. Phil, I know that you kind of swum in this pool too. You've done some swimming. And do you have any comments, any thoughts?
Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, well, I've had the experience of having the customer in the middle of the project change the nature of the project from being one of research to being one of development toward delivery. And if it's not well established and documented well enough up front in, say, a charter, this is the direction you're going. If you want to make a change, fine, we might make that change, but you now have a strong basis for the consequences of that change and not being held accountable for those consequences.
But to me, it comes back to...
Oh, let's get the...
To me, what you just said comes back to Earth. Mm-hmm. A well written charter, because that defines your need, right? So if you have a broad charter, we're gonna, blow up half of Africa.
No, Heidi's going there.
The idea of hypothetical, right?
Where some of your stakeholders are going to be conditional upon you succeeding
getting things to a certain level of maturity. And we deal mostly in TRLs, and if you're familiar with that scale, you know, and it takes about an order of magnitude more investment to get from, to go up a TRL level. And as you go up those levels, more and more of the stakeholders get involved because it's not just proving the technology. Now, how are you going to maintain it? How are you going to operate it? How are you going to integrate it in with all the other parts of the system that currently it doesn't interact with or doesn't interface to while you're developing the technology, and what are the derived requirements from those interfaces? So, you know, you don't want to necessarily over-engineer the early phases, but if you're not thinking about that path, you end up going down something that's effectively going to be a dead end.
Yeah, one of the things I did not mention about the mission assurance framework at Sandia, we have consideration throughout all the life cycle phases, and I love what you said because it's almost context. Let me say phase sensitive. Things will expand as you get further down the development road by higher tier on maturity. Cheryl.
Lucky me. So my ignorance again in systems engineering and being somewhat of a novel person, you talked about early stage systems engineering, we're going to have the biggest bang for the buck. As somebody who does a lot of human systems integration work, HSI, we really only get any buy-in at the requirement stage. And so if we don't get early buy-in at the requirement stage, human system integration cannot be done later on in the project. It can't be done, you know, the charter, you might want this hypersonic weapon that's going to go fly around the world and do whatever. But who the heck's going to program it? What's that going to get it put in it? How are they going to? They're going to do it after the fact, and now it's going to cost you a lot more money. And so, to me, it's something that somehow gets overlooked a lot of times. So,
I'm going to channel Rick here for a second. I mean, HSI is maybe one example of that, but you know, building in security, building in quality, it's not like a miracle at the very end.
Right,
and it's much harder to downstream try to engineer them. Any other thoughts? We're pretty much out of time. It's 7:15.
I'd like to raise one question. This is early TRL work, I presume, and it's. This falls under the heading of research, and my expectation is that research in early TRL stages has got to deal with experimentation and alternatives as opposed to marching down a single path. And that concept to me needs the word management put after it somewhere, to ensure that it actually happens instead of somebody just deciding this is the path we're going to take and we'll prove it's right.
Okay. Great. Yeah, and I want to point out, I think that in the nature of system engineering is that you can always recycle, because I agree with you, in that you know, you can't have changing requirements, but you have to have the discipline to finish up what you're doing and say, okay, now we have some other stakeholders that want these requirements, and then you go back and you change your term. So being able to circle back and having the discipline to do that, that's the key, is like you can't just like in the middle of it say, oh, by the way, we're going to have MVP additional requirements, like, well, then you got to circle back. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you got to remember that the nature of engineering allows for circular, you know, that's the agile concept and that, those kinds of things, too, that allow you to go back and move on to the requirements. So if you do it in a disciplined manner, you can say, yeah, that's a great requirement, but this is not going to do that.
Oh, oh wait, we need to.
Yeah, there's another factor that also needs to be addressed and it's hard to predict, and that is emergent behavior. Because typically when you're in the early stages, you're dealing with the component in isolation. And, you know, there are going potential interactions that you're not going to be able to observe until you start to integrate it into a higher level of assembly. And, you know, when you start doing that, there's always that opportunity for unexpected emergent behavior to occur. And it's usually beneficial.
Yeah, very good. Okay. Well, unfortunately, I hate to deliver the bad news, but I think we're at the end of our time for the challenges. We went through 2 out of 3, but Rick, I would encourage you for the 3rd annual engineering challenge. We'd love to explore the profiling compatibility strategy. Okay. So anyway, thank you, everybody. Thank you for participating. Thank you for your energy, your ideas. I will be typing up these notes, such as they are, and sending them out to our folks here that have participated, but we'll also have them part of our quarterly newsletter. Okay? So thank you very much, and the next chapter meeting, we will have a speaker that's going to discuss biomimicry and considerations for architecture and design. Okay? Anyway, thank you, everybody.